Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, exploring ideas to enhancing national competitiveness. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The IBM Center has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Proh, who brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. What can our nation do to better compete in today's global economy? How can creating a strategic approach to federal budget decisions enhance national competitiveness? And what are the practical steps required to move toward a more strategic way of budgeting? Today, we'll explore these questions and so much more with Steve Redburn, Study Director at the National Academy of Science and contributor to Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches. Steve, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
America can't address its economic prospects without a clear understanding of what it means to be competitive. Given your piece for this new book, Governing to Win, what is national competitiveness? Can you give us a sense in your mind, what exactly does that mean?
Okay, I'm not going to give you a formal economist definition of that because I'm not an economist, I'm a political scientist. But in my mind, the key to our competitiveness is building on our comparative advantages. We have great strengths relative to other countries that allow us to produce things that people want to buy, services and goods that people want to buy around the world. And we also have major liabilities that we have to manage going forward if we're going to remain competitive. But I want to emphasize that we start this competition, if you like, or we are in this competition with tremendous assets, not least of all our governing system. Our governance is world class by most standards. By international standards, we have a clean government. We have an analytically sophisticated government that operates relatively efficiently. We have decentralized a lot of decision-making to states and local governments, which allow us to manage very complicated problems better than we could if we had a more centralized system. So I just want to start with that. And then there are a lot of other assets. We have this huge domestic economy, which allows us to pilot and try new approaches. We're a very innovative society, a very entrepreneurial society still. We have graduate schools that are the envy of the world, and you know, hundreds of them, really. So we have these tremendous world-class assets on which to build. The key is to build on those to address our weaknesses going forward so we can increase the rate of productivity and increase the rate of growth going forward, because that's the key to addressing our liabilities.
Well, that's nice. It sets a good context around your piece for the book, which is titled Creating a Strategic Approach to Budget Decisions. And I'd like to turn to that particularly. At the core, as you point out in your piece, of any well-functioning government is a budget process that policymakers can use to make big decisions about resources in a rational manner. Would you describe for us, to the extent you can, the U.S. budget process?
Well, first of all, there are two features of our process that are structural and constitutional that really we can't do much about. One is that we have divided responsibility between two branches of government, the president and Congress, who have to share power and agree on policies before they're legislated. And the budget is all done by legislation at the federal level. And then we also have a system of federal division between states and the federal government. So we have 50 autonomous states making their own budget decisions, are sovereign, have their own sources of revenue. And even in other federal systems, there's more centralization and coordination of fiscal choices at the national level than there is in this country. So those are two enduring structural features that we're not going to change anytime soon. But the best way to describe the current process is really with a metaphor. If you've seen these slow motion replays of major car wrecks in a NASCAR race where all the pieces are flying apart and people are bouncing off one another and so on, that's really what has happened to the relatively orderly process that we've had since 1974 in both the Congress and the executive, but especially in Congress. The process has fragmented, flown apart. In the best of times, it was weak at the center, stovepiped, fragmented among committees, and so on. But recently, it has just stopped working. And so we've lurched from crisis to crisis. Appropriations have not been made on time. A lot of uncertainty for everyone because of the breakdown of that process at a bad time.
And you mentioned in your piece that the process has collapsed, I think was the word. What are some of the key factors that have contributed to the situation?
Well, one thing that put the system under great stress in the recent past is the financial crisis and other emergencies on top of that, decisions to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, decisions that were largely made on an emergency basis outside the ordinary process. So because the process was working sluggishly, not on time, those decisions couldn't be made through the ordinary process. And also we have made a choice to put a lot of programs, so-called mandatory programs, on autopilot and not to revisit them on a regular or annual basis. So at this point, only about 40% of the federal spending is appropriated annually. Authority expires each year and has to be renewed. So more and more of the government is spending, and also tax policy in its entirety, is on autopilot. It's not revisited automatically every year. So we're fragmented in time as well as across jurisdictions.
Well, you point out in your piece for the book that cutting costs without a strategic approach or raising taxes without tax reform could risk a period of slow growth and austerity that could cripple all efforts and threaten our position in the world. Would you elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, the simplest thing to do when you have to cut back in the short run because you're running huge deficits is to sort of cut across the board. It's intellectually easier, and politically it's a shortcut. Even in the short run, that does a lot of damage. Things change from year to year. You know, war ends, we have new challenges, a pandemic next year or a major natural disaster or something else looms up, or a new opportunity to invest in new technology, for example. So priorities change quite a bit from year to year. And when the government can't complete, when the congressional process breaks down and government can't complete appropriations or can't complete them on time at the start of the fiscal year in October, then there's a lot of hidden damage that's done across agencies having to essentially live with the terms and conditions and amounts that they lived with the year before, even though there's been a lot of change. And if you, on top of that, then are ratcheting down everybody, you have additional disconnects and inefficiencies that arise. That's the short term. But in the long term, if you're not more strategic and targeted in the way you invest your resources, if you just let things drift along and move incrementally and adjust at the margins, over time, government's critical contribution to the success of the economy and its growth weakens. And that's what's been happening on both the spending side and the tax side. Mm-hmm. Tax policy is a result of a lot of individual narrow choices that favor one use of capital or income over another. No one has, since 1986, revisited the whole income tax system. So a number of small changes in the tax code have accumulated to mean that there are over $1 trillion of tax expenditures or gaps in the tax structure that function much like spending, but are not treated like spending in the appropriations process and are never looked at. And many of them probably are not optimal use of our resources. So they're simultaneously reductions in taxes and increases in subsidies for particular sectors of the economy, such as the mortgage interest deduction for homeownership, that are potentially counterproductive. In fact, in that case, did great damage to people's savings and net worth over the last 3 or 4 years.
So with that, the current state as you described it, it does present an opportunity for reform. It's an opening for reform. And I want to switch gears to talk about to what extent does this kind of situation that you describe lead to an opportunity to reform it?
Well, that's a good question. We have tried to solve this problem of the weaknesses in the current budget process by ad hoc measures such as the negotiations behind closed doors around the debt limit increase, which resulted in the Budget Control Act and the creation of a super committee, bipartisan, of the House and the Senate to try to, again, behind closed doors, come up with a grand bargain, a big package of savings that would help put the budget back on track, that is, would over the long term close the gap between revenues that are now projected and our commitments, which are outrunning our expected revenues. That process failed. It broke down. So that does create a question, at least, if not an opportunity. You know, is there a need to go back and look at the regular process and see if we can make it function? I think I would say yes, because even if there is a grand bargain, either on this side of the fiscal cliff that's coming after the election or on the other side, something like that that involves so much pain and difficult choices is going to have to be sustained through the regular budget process ultimately. And the regular budget process allows for public debate. It's more out in the open. And we need that kind of public debate to legitimize and sustain any agreements that are reached at a leadership level between parties and between the executive and the legislative branch.
I'd like to get your insights on how a properly functioning budget process would help stabilize and in fact, reduce potentially the federal government's debt.
Okay. The context here is that, as I said, we have a long-term debt problem, which we have to wrestle with. It's again, another metaphor is that the fiscal problems of the federal government were a big ship. It's headed toward the rocks, and it takes a long time to turn a big ship. And the closer we get to the rocks, the sharper the turn has to be, and the more likely that we'll have something occur that will push us back into a recession. And as I said, the fiscal cliff that's coming at the end of the year, which I think people understand now means if nothing is done, automatic increases in taxes, ending the payroll tax cut that has been in place for 2 years, a new decision on the debt limit, and a variety of other policy changes that will occur automatically, including a sequester, which would be an across-the-board cut in discretionary spending, both defense and non-defense, would, according to CBO's report this week, would put us back into recession and greatly complicate our problem. So we've got to come to grips with that. And as I said, we've tried the odd hook behind closed door approach. So we really need to get back to thinking about how to reform and make work the regular process. And ultimately, when we make these big choices, we have to do it in a way that's strategic.
Yeah, and actually, you know, picking up on thinking about it and having folks think about it, you reference in your piece for Governing to Win the Peterson-Pugh Commission on Budget Reform. Would you tell us more about this effort and highlight some of the recommendations it offered?
Sure. That commission, which is housed with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation, is the project is ended now, but it was made up of former budget directors, both the OMB, Office of Management and Budget, the President's Budget Office, and the Congressional Budget Office. And heads of budget committees and senior budget committee staff on the Hill. In other words, old hands, people who have collectively hundreds of years of experience with the current process. So they were a very practical group, and they approached this problem in a practical way. And they looked at the structure that was created in 1974, which is not working very well now, but they said what needs to be done to make it work and what needs to be done to make it capable of addressing the long-term challenges that we face. The core of their approach was to take the current requirements and add to them a requirement that we set a target to stabilize the debt in the medium term, maybe 8-10 years out, which would require turning the big ship, and then estimate each year the budget savings over that period of time that would be required cumulatively in order to and annually to achieve that, and then to require the Congress through its regular procedures to hit those annual and multi-year targets, and to do so with stronger centralized authority in the budget committees. In 1974, when this structure was created, there was a big fight with the appropriators. Appropriators weakened the center, weakened the budget committees. But for this approach to work, they really need to be instruments of the leadership in both the House and the Senate. And the appropriators perhaps should have people sitting on the maybe their chairs should be sitting on the budget committee so that they become the organizing instrument for the leadership to have a rational process of setting priorities and moving money where it can be used more effectively. So that's really the core of what they tried to do. They also added, they also paid a lot of attention to the need to add transparency to the process and to recognize costs as they accrue, to recognize many costs that are actually going to hit the budget but are not now looked at in real time or are not even on the budget, such as the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for example, were not part of the budget, and yet they obviously had huge budget consequences when they failed.
Well, beyond those reforms, or maybe in a complement to those reforms, you point out that the U.S. needs an approach that is more strategic in its scope and capacity to prioritize the use of resources. What would that new rigorous review process look like? Could you give us a sense?
Sure. Well, in broad terms, it's going to require three things. It's going to require a new information about benefits and performance especially, and also a new alignment of information on benefits, what we get for our money, the results that we expect, with cost information. Right now, the structure of the budget doesn't align what we're trying to achieve with the way the accounting keeps track of the amounts and appropriates the amounts. So we need to restructure the information that goes into the process. I mean, we need new decision methods. Paul Posner, who is at George Mason University and a budget expert, and I call the approach that's needed a portfolio budgeting approach, where we say, here's a major goal of the enduring mission and or major short-term, medium-term goal that we're trying to achieve, better childhood readiness for school or better, you know, some aspect of health or whatever it is we consider a high-priority national objective. And then we look at all of the efforts that are underway and available for the federal government to achieve that goal and treat that as a portfolio of spending, of tax expenditures, also regulations, which are alternatives to spending and are often ways of leveraging changes in people's personal behavior, for example, that don't require direct spending. Look at the costs and benefits of all of the alternatives, taking that package as a set, and see if we can separate the wheat from the chaff and use that pool of resources more productively to drive progress toward that goal, whatever it is, and at the same time achieve budget savings. So that's an example of how we would reorganize the decision process. And then we need new executive and congressional budget procedures to support that more strategic approach. But the essence of it is setting clear, high-priority goals and then organizing information to and analyzing it to decide how to use our resources more effectively to drive toward those goals. At the same time, eliminating spending and tax expenditures that are not productive or relatively unproductive.
How can creating a strategic approach to federal budget decisions enhance national competitiveness? We will explore this question and so much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns.